En matière de connaissances clients, les marketeurs B2B ont encore des progrès à faire, car aussi invraisemblable que cela puisse paraître, puisqu'il s'agit de l'essence même de leur métier, ceux-ci n'auraient pas toujours une idée claire de ce que veulent réellement les acheteurs. À l'écoute de cette interview d'Andrew Deutsch de Fangle Group, il se peut bien que quelques-uns d'entre nous, qui ont une expérience significative du marketing B2B, retrouvent quelques souvenirs émus du terrain. Dans ce podcast, Andrew évoque le décalage entre ce que les marketeurs, je cite, « perçoivent comme les exigences des clients », fermez les guillemets, et ce que leurs clients désirent et apprécient réellement dans les produits et services de leurs fournisseurs. À la fin de cette discussion, les spécialistes du marketing business to business pourront réfléchir à l'intérêt d'écouter les clients et d'élaborer des plans d'action fondés sur des études qualitatives.
Des interviews, des chiffres, des faits, des études, pas de blabla, ce sont les podcasts de Visionary Marketing, disponibles sur toutes les bonnes chaînes de balado-diffusion.
Bonjour, je suis Yann Gorenek, merci d'écouter les podcasts de Visionary Marketing. Le sujet du jour, connaissance client, les marketeurs B2B ont encore des progrès à faire, avec Andrew Deutsch de Fangle Group en direct de Cleveland, Ohio, dont vous retrouverez une version intégrale en anglais à la fin de ce podcast en français pour ceux qui désirent se familiariser avec la langue de Shakespeare ou d'Edgar Allan Poe, ce selon les interprétations. Les entreprises du B2B ont bien quelques notions de compréhension des besoins, m'a expliqué Andrew Deutsch, mais elles n'ont pas de connaissances assez profondes de leurs clients alors qu'elles le devraient. L'un des principaux problèmes est que les entreprises font la promotion de choses dont elles sont fières et sur lesquelles elles ont fondé leur activité d'une manière qui n'a pas vraiment d'importance pour le client. C'est parce que ce ne sont pas les motivations ou les raisons sous-jacentes pour lesquelles leurs acheteurs font des affaires avec elles. Il n'y a pas une région du monde où Andrew n'a pas rencontré ce problème à des degrés divers. Certains pays comme l'Allemagne ou le nord de l'Italie ont des compétences en ingénierie industrielle très fortes et sont encore plus exposés à ces problèmes selon lui. Les entreprises de ces régions ne reconnaissent parfois pas toujours la nécessité de saisir les exigences de leurs clients, ni de mieux les servir pour qu'ils se sentent valorisés et fassent partie de l'entreprise. Imaginons que vous fabriquiez des voitures et que vos ingénieurs soient responsables des ventes. L'acheteur d'une nouvelle voiture recherche certains bénéfices, par exemple, il veut impressionner les personnes du sexe opposé et être le mec le plus cool, explique Andrew. Je laisse cet exemple et sa responsabilité à l'auteur de l'interview. Il parle à l'ingénieur et ce dernier lui dit « Cette machine a une puissance de X chevaux, nous utilisons un type d'acier Y, etc. Le client potentiel n'a que faire de tout cela. Est-ce que je vais impressionner les filles ?» Voilà ce qu'il se demande. Il est donc possible que l'acheteur d'une voiture de sport ait un état d'esprit très différent de celui des personnes qui la conçoivent et la commercialisent. Lorsque vous parvenez à combler ce fossé qui vous sépare de la valeur réelle désirée par les clients, il devient beaucoup plus facile de se mettre à leur place et de leur montrer que votre solution est celle qu'il leur faut. Prenons un exemple pour éclaircir ce point, ajoute Andrew. Disons que nous, en tant que clients B2B, travaillons à l'achat d'une toute nouvelle machine de découpe laser de haute technologie pour notre entreprise de fabrication. Nous voulons que cette machine de découpe laser soit capable de découper jusqu'à une certaine épaisseur, quelques millimètres, d'acier à une qualité, un taux et une vitesse prédéterminée. Trois fournisseurs proposent la machine qui répond à nos exigences et les prix sont assez similaires. Mais en tant que fabricant, que dois-je rechercher? La machine doit faire le boulot, certes, mais je voudrais aussi m'assurer qu'un service client de qualité a été mis en place. Quel est le coût annuel en énergie de cette machine? Combien de temps pour remettre la machine en marche? S'agit-il d'une machine dont les composants sont modulaires? Ce sont tous ces éléments que je recherche vraiment en tant que client. Je veux m'assurer que cette machine n'interrompra jamais ma production. Le fait qu'une machine fasse son travail est la base. Les clients ne parlent pas aux entreprises qui ne répondent pas à leurs exigences techniques, m'a expliqué Andrew Deutsch. Ce qu'ils demandent vraiment, cependant, c'est le service client et la formation, tout ce qui les rassure, car ce qu'ils souhaitent vraiment acheter, c'est la certitude que cette machine ne leur posera aucun problème. Voici un autre exemple pris chez un des clients du grand public de Fangle Group. Deux femmes brillantes ont hérité de l'entreprise de leur grand-père. Ce dernier a inventé une formule pour l'érythème fessier en 1927. 4 ou 5 générations de familles ont compté sur ce produit, mais ils n'ont pas connu plus de 3 à 5% de croissance des ventes pendant des années. Ils étaient fiers de ce superbe produit dont la composition réputée avait été trouvée par leur grand-père dans les années 30. Les équipes d'Andrew ont effectué des recherches qualitatives et se sont entretenues avec des parents afin de savoir à quoi ils pensaient lorsqu'ils achetaient une crème contre l'érythème fessier. Aucun d'entre eux n'avait la moindre idée de la nature de la composition de cette crème dont la société était si fière. Ce qu'ils voulaient, c'était des garanties. A. Un bébé en bonne santé. B. En tant que parent, tout ce qui me permettrait de passer une bonne nuit de sommeil car je ne veux pas me réveiller avec un bébé malade. C. Enfin, l'élément clé, j'achète des produits pour dire à mes beaux-parents et à mes parents que je suis un bon parent et que je sais ce que je fais. Lorsqu'ils ont construit une campagne autour de ces éléments, leur produit est devenu beaucoup plus attractif pour les parents. En fin de compte, l'entreprise s'est transformée. Voici un exemple pris du B2C hein, qui peut être une source d'inspiration pour le B2B et qui montre finalement, hein, malgré tous les blablas, que finalement, c'est pas si différent que cela d'un domaine à un autre. Prenons encore un exemple, poursuit Andrew. Il y a quelques années, je travaillais dans la division des rubans à haute performance d'une entreprise du Fortune 100, nous dit-il, dans le domaine des adhésifs. Lorsque nous parlions aux acheteurs, notre principal concurrent, qui fabriquait un produit similaire, était 3M, un des meilleurs fabricants. Chaque fois que nous parlions à un acheteur, on nous renvoyait que leur solution était meilleure, moins chère et mieux livrée. On nous disait, poursuit-il, je ne suis pas prêt à prendre le risque de changer parce que personne ne s'est jamais fait virer en achetant 3M. Et c'est ainsi que 3M a formé des générations d'ambassadeurs de la marque chez ses clients. Acheter chez nous, c'est la sécurité, semblait-il dire. Encore une fois, ce n'est pas le produit ou ce que le produit peut faire qui importe. Quand un problème intervient, le client se dit « ça ne peut pas être ma faute, j'ai acheté 3M ». Nous avons donc dû lancer des stratégies de contournement dont la substance était cet argument. C'est peut-être vrai, mais celui qui a pris un petit risque avec nous a eu une grosse promotion en retour car nous offrons la garantie de la qualité et cela lui a permis de prouver au patron qu'il fallait prendre ce risque pour le bénéfice de l'entreprise. Mon produit est meilleur et plus compétitif. Nous avons transformé nos dialogues avec les acheteurs en prouvant notre capacité à faire d'eux des héros de l'entreprise. En reprenant la même conversation avec les responsables de la production, je leur ai dit, poursuit Andrew, « Le produit que vous utilisez actuellement prend beaucoup de temps et présente certains problèmes. Nous pouvons résoudre ces problèmes et vous rendre la vie plus facile grâce à notre produit. Combien de fois avez-vous eu un rappel ou un problème que notre produit aurait pu résoudre et vous permettant de continuer à faire votre travail sans préoccupation ? Quel directeur de la production n'aimerait pas avoir moins de problèmes dans la vie ? Notre mission est de résoudre vos problèmes. » Il s'agit de relier donc ces éléments le long de la chaîne de valeur lorsque vous envisagez toutes les personnes impliquées dans une décision, explique Andrew Deutsch. C'est peut-être la technologie qui est coupable de cette situation, m'a expliqué Andrew. Les gens se sont rués sur les commandes automatiques et la communication digitale, tandis que les acheteurs sont devenus plus avisés sur la façon de trouver le bon prix. Les entreprises ont donc été amenées à moins s'appesantir sur les services. C'est pourquoi dans les années 90, la vente par la solution est passée à la trappe. Aujourd'hui, nous nous rendons compte que nous ne servons pas correctement nos clients et que nous devrions exploiter la technologie pour mieux le faire. La vente est redevenue humaine et il existe de nombreux outils qui peuvent vous faire revenir aux fondamentaux. La réalité est aujourd'hui, comme elle l'était il y a 100 ans et elle le sera dans 100 ans encore, les gens auront toujours besoin de faire des affaires avec des gens pour se rassurer. J'ai vu des usines fermer complètement pendant des jours, a ajouté Andrew, parce qu'il leur manquait un composant de 10 cents, à cause d'une personne qui n'a pas noué les contacts nécessaires pour s'adapter à un changement de calendrier, ni n'a cherché le moyen pour trouver d'autres sources d'approvisionnement. Nous devons tous prendre conscience de l'importance de la relation humaine dans la vente face aux besoins du client. Il ne s'agit pas seulement de caractéristiques ni de fonctionnalités, les caractéristiques techniques ne sont rien d'autre que la preuve que les bénéfices clients sont réels. Voici enfin les conseils en 5 minutes montre en main qu'Andrew distille aux patrons d'entreprise et aux spécialistes du marketing inter-entreprise qui ne connaissent pas les douleurs, pain points de leurs clients et qui aimeraient mieux les connaître. Premièrement, faites une liste de vos 10 clients les plus fidèles, nous dit-il. Trouvez 10 clients qui peuvent ou non acheter exclusivement chez vous ou qui pourraient vous quitter un jour et trouvez 10 clients qui vous ont dit au revoir. Contactez-les et demandez-leur. Pourquoi avez-vous choisi de faire affaire avec nous ? Qu'est-ce qui vous plaît chez nous ? Que pourrions-nous améliorer ? Puis, c'est le deuxième point, vous analysez ces réponses basées sur des entretiens organisés très professionnellement. Attention, si ces interviews ne sont pas bien menées, la recherche qualitative peut vous faire prendre de mauvaises décisions. On vous renvoie d'ailleurs à ce sujet aux diverses méthodologies de Visionary Marketing sur les études qualitatives et autres. Troisièmement, presque chaque fois que nous le faisons, a déclaré Andrew, les graines qui doivent être semées sont évidentes. Je le cite. Vous comprendrez ainsi quel message doit être modifié pour mettre l'accent sur une touche plus personnelle sur le service au client et transmettre à votre acheteur l'impression réelle que vous vous souciez de son entreprise. Notre interview avec Andrew a permis de dévoiler les raisons pour lesquelles les entreprises du B2B, mais peut-être aussi les autres d'ailleurs, échouent à se développer malgré l'excellence de leurs produits. Il y a encore du pain sur la planche pour nous, les spécialistes du marketing B2B, en mal de connaissances clients. Pourquoi donc ne pas inviter vos meilleurs clients à prendre une tasse de café ou organiser une discussion au coin du feu avec les acheteurs les plus fidèles ? Il existe peut-être d'autres façons de connaître vos clients B2B, mais celles-ci, pour commencer, sont assurément un bon début. Et maintenant, je vous laisse en compagnie de Andrew Deutsch pour cette version intégrale en anglais de l'interview que j'ai réalisée avec lui.
Right, I'm here with Andrew Deutsch from the Fangl Group. Hi, Andrew. You're talking from the Cleveland region, from what I understand.
Yeah, Cleveland, Ohio, in the U.S. It's good to be on. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So, Fangl Group is a group dedicated to strategy, isn't it? And you have a good track record in that area throughout the world.
Correct. Yeah, we base our business on strategy before tactics in the marketing and sales arena, and we work both here in the U.S. and globally.
Okay, and our topic today is going to be why so many businesses don't know who their customers are. Well, that's an interesting topic. I thought that everybody knew who their customers were.
Well, I think they have a notion, but they don't necessarily really understand that one of the major problems that we see on a regular basis is companies that are out really promoting the things that they're so proud of that they founded their business on and operate every day in ways that really don't matter to that customer because those aren't the reasons that people do business with them.
So they're very proud of themselves, but they're not really interested in what the customers are thinking.
I wouldn't go as far as to say proud of their self. It's not an ego thing, but like for example, a very high tech metal fabrication company. They're so proud that they use these high precision laser cutting equipment, and they've got skilled welders in house, and they have painting capabilities. All these kinds of things that are things to be proud of. But when you talk to the customer, they're looking for someone that can really understand their problem. They're looking for someone that can meet their time needs, that can provide customer service and all of the benefits that a company can provide. Because everyone in that space has great high-tech ability to make stuff. But do you have the ability to truly serve that customer for what their needs are, not the features that they're looking for?
Is this something that you come across throughout the world, or are there certain regions where it's a little bit more acute than others?
I don't recall a region of the world where we haven't come across it. There are places where it's far worse than others. Mm-hmm. There are countries, I'll call one out. Mm-hmm. We find a lot of times in markets that have very strong engineering backgrounds, like the German market, and even in the northern part of Italy, where there's great engineering and manufacturing, that the companies really lead with their technical abilities and don't recognize the need to serve the customer so that the customer mm-hmm. feels that they're valued and part of the business.
Yeah. Having said that, industrial Germany has been a leader throughout the world, and they are the only ones who actually managed to sell stuff to the Chinese, for instance.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I've sold a lot of stuff to the Chinese over the years. It didn't come from Germany, but the challenge is if you let let's make it a little easier to think about. Imagine that you put your engineers in charge of sales and you manufacture cars. Mm-hmm. So the consumer for a new car is looking for certain benefits from that car. They may be a safety buyer. I'm looking for a car that's safe for my family. They may be a comfort buyer. They may be a buyer looking for that car that's impressive. And then you let the engineers come forward, and they've built a very great, wonderful, functioning car. But the guy who's looking for that impact of, I want to impress people of the opposite gender because I'm just want to be the coolest person ever. And they talk to the engineer, and the engineer says, well, this has this many horsepower and we use this type of steel, and the torque is this and that. And the guy's like, I don't care about any of that. Am I going to impress the girls? So the buyer of a sports car starts with a very different mindset than maybe the people who designed it and are marketing it. So there, when you can bridge that disconnect to what is the actual value that that person wants to get out of their purchase, it's much easier to meet them at their model of the world and show them that you're the right solution.
But isn't there any examples where buyers, I mean, mostly in the industrial field, which is, seems to be the one that you're talking about here, are really interested in technical features, however?
Yeah, there typically are those requirements. But at the end of the day, imagine you and I are working to purchase a brand new high-tech laser cutting machine for our manufacturing company. You and I are now business partners. And we've talked to several of them. We know that we want that laser cutter to be able to cut up to X number of millimeters of steel at a certain grade, at a certain rate and speed. And we now have three manufacturers that have the machine that does that. And the pricing is somewhat similar. But as a manufacturer, what am I looking for? It'll do what I need it to do. I'm buying that laser cutter, but I want to make sure, is there service available? What is the annual cost to power that machine? How quickly can I repair downtime? Is it something that has modular components? Mm-hmm. So all of those things are what I'm really looking for. I want to make sure that this machine never shuts down my production. The fact that it can cut and do those things, that's the table stakes. I'm not going to talk to companies that don't meet those requirements of the capability of doing. But what I really want is customer service. I want training. I want all of those other things so that I know that I can feel comfortable, because what I'm looking to buy is comfort that this machine not only can, but won't cause me other problems.
Okay, I understand you. This is very similar to what is... what we come across in the high-tech field as well. So there's sure. A lot of people, high-tech producers are actually able to produce the same kind of stuff more or less. Mm-hmm. And differentiation doesn't happen at that level. Is that something that you, this thing that so many businesses don't know who their customers are, is that something that you've come across in B2C, in the B2C industry as well?
Absolutely. I just had a conversation with someone about his business. That they were in the business of marketing high-rise condominiums in the western part of Canada. Mm-hmm. And they were working from the old demographic model that people who could afford those are boomers, which are people that have lots of money. Mm-hmm. So they built these incredible marketing campaigns to sell these buildings. And they got very lucky, because after all of the apartments were sold, they had this interesting opportunity. Let's go back and see who bought them. Almost no one was a boomer. The entire concept of who would buy and who could afford, they were wrong. Boomers didn't buy those apartments. They were young, up and coming entrepreneurs and business people with families. So they got lucky that the horrible marketing that they did didn't matter, because people wanted those apartments anyhow. So in the consumer space, and an example, there's a client of ours, two brilliant women inherited their grandfather's business. He invented a diaper rash formula in 1927, and they've been selling that formula for generations of people. There's four and five generations in families that have relied on that product, but they haven't seen more than 3-5% growth in years in sales. So they were out there talking about what a brilliant product it is because of those ingredients that are so famous that grandpa invented back in 1927. Well, we did a bit of qualitative research and talked to people who had already had children, people who were currently with babies at home, and people who are planning on having kids, to find out what are the motivators. What do you care about in terms of your purchasing decision to buy diaper rash cream? Well, guess what? None of them had any idea what the ingredients even were. What they wanted was a guarantee. Number one, healthy baby. Number two, as a parent, anything that would get me a good night's sleep. because I don't want to wake up with a sick baby. And the one, and of course, other companies were talking about that. So that really wasn't the key. The key was the third. I buy products to tell my in-laws and my parents, I'm a good parent, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing. And when they built the campaign on that, the diaper rash cream became far more attractive in the market to parents, because this is the proof I'm a good parent. Leave me alone. Let me be a parent. And that was the motivator that turned the company around.
Well, you seem to put the finger on it, actually. It's understanding what your customers want. And obviously customer research comes into play, and it works for B2C, but it works for B2B and even industrial products. So can you tell us a little bit more about this and how you can solve this issue of not knowing what your customers want?
The B2C space is one where this has been part of the ethos of marketing for years. In the B2B space, selling to business, selling to industry, up until less than, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, business to business marketing was, you know, as we joke in the US, a box of donuts and a sell sheet. So nobody really recognized how important it was to truly understand and the needs of the buyers and the people along the purchasing chain. In the consumer space, typically a decision is made by one person or a partner. In the business space, there's many more people in that value chain that make the decision to buy. Mm. So how do you learn what's to the advantage of the buyer? How do you learn what's to the advantage of the operations people that are going to use the product or whatever? And that's where our techniques come into play. So, mm-hmm. so for example, years ago, I worked with a multinational company called Avery Dennison. It's a Fortune 100 company in the adhesive space. And I was in the performance tapes division of it. So when we would talk to buyers, our biggest competitor that made a similar product was 3M. Mm-hmm. Now 3M is, you know, globally known, they're brilliant. And we would come across every time we talked to a buyer about a better solution at a better price with better delivery. And they would say, I'm not willing to take the risk because nobody ever got fired selling 3M, buying 3M. That was, it was, I heard it in Spanish. I've heard it in Portuguese. I've heard it in French. It's what they've trained the voracious advocates of 3M. Buying from us is safety. Again, it's not the product and what the product can do, but when something fails, you go, hey, it couldn't be my fault. I bought 3M. So we had to create campaign and conversations about, yeah, that might be true, but whoever got promoted and became the king of the company by taking a small risk that with a guarantee of a quality that we have and prove to the boss that you're willing to stick your chest out, stick your neck out there and do better for the company. I have a better product with a better price and better conditions. And we turned our entire conversation with potential customers into us being able to make you a hero to the buyer. And that then, if so, yeah, nobody ever got fired, but nobody ever grew buying from 3M, buy from us. And then the same conversation then at the next level of the operations folks, you're always wanting, you know, the current one that you're using takes this much time. It has these issues. We can resolve those problems and make your life easier with our product. How often have you had a recall or you've had a problem that our product could have solved so that you could just continue to do your job and have an easy life? What production manager wouldn't like to have less problems in their life? We solve problems. So those value pieces along that chain, when you figure out all the people involved in that decision, there was a company that made specialty fasteners that were used in manufacturing. There was no difference between their fastener and a competitor. I believe they probably were made in the same factory. Mm-hmm. But how were we able to get that business as an industrial distributor, which is a client of mine? Well, we set up direct, absolute, guaranteed that the bins would always be full. As long as we have your production schedule, you won't even have to think about us. We match price, but we will never shut down your production for lack of one part. It won't happen. And sure enough, that was the value that buyer needed. You mean I can go home and go to sleep at night and not get a call on the third shift when they run out of pieces? So all of those are the kind of deeper dive than just I've got a product that works and I got the best price.
Mm. But to an extent, I mean, everything you're talking about solving people's problems and it sounds very much like solution selling in the 1980s, doesn't it? I mean, all this stuff has been around forever in B2B. And how come B2B companies in 2021 still, you know, stuck there not knowing what customers want and what they don't want?
Yeah, I've got theories on it. And the one that stands out for me, and I don't know this to be fact, but this is my hypothesis of what happened. Technology got in the way. So what happened was all of a sudden people were going to automatic ordering, people were going to digital communication, and buyers became more sort of savvy in how to find that pricing, and it caused people to provide less service. So there was, in the 90s, we had a drop in that solution selling. And now we're recognizing that we're not properly servicing our customers and we need to go back to it, and we can leverage the technology to do it better.
Interesting. So, interesting about this thing about automation. That's a nice dog.
This is going out audio only, correct?
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Yeah. So people are wondering why we're laughing as we're recording. Well, my dogs have taken over my studio.
a bit of fun is actually quite nice, actually, in B2B. So that's very, very interesting what you're saying about this drop in customer service in the 1990s. We've sort of gone backwards to an extent, and we need to actually move forward. And rather than try to automate everything and go through automated systems and whatnot. So it means like sales going back to the human factor, basically.
Yeah, it really has. And there's lots of tools out there that allow you to do that and be just as efficient as you were when you weren't being a human being to your customer.
Okay.
Now, it's incredible sometimes when I deal with even the youngest folks who think that, you know, just send a text to the guy and you're going to be in business. And the reality is today, as it was 100 years ago, and it will be 100 years from now, people will still need to do business with people to make sure that you have the assurances. You know, every time a buyer makes a purchase, their neck is on the line if they screw it up. I've seen factories literally shut down for days because they're missing a 10-cent component. Mm-hmm. Somebody didn't have the relationship that when the schedule changed, they were able to adjust for it or alternative sources. And I mean, there's just so many things that can happen that we all need to recognize that human connection and selling to the needs of the customer, not the you know, when you go back to marketing school, and I don't know in Europe if they teach the same, but here it was always talking about features and benefits. And the first thing that we train folks in my organization is it's benefits and features. They got it in the wrong order.
Mm.
Features are nothing more than proof that the benefits are real.
Yeah.
If I tell you my equipment can do this and it's going to do this for your organization, how can you prove that? Well, these are the features.
Yeah. That's music to my ears. And it's good news as well, because it means that there's going to be a lot of work for complex salespeople, and there's going to be a lot of work for marketeers as well.
Now, absolutely.
Going back to these business owners who actually do not know what their customers are and what their pain points are and how to solve them, what would be your 5-minute advice to improve that situation? What should they do?
If they're contracting with us, or if they want to do it internally, make a list. Find the 10 most loyal customers that you have. Find 10 customers that may or may not buy from you exclusively or may split their purchasing. And find 10 customers that told you goodbye. And find a way to reach out and ask the question, why did you choose to do business with my business? What turns you on, and what could we do better? And the interview process is much more complex than that. We have a very strategic way that we go about it. Mm-hmm. The top 10 customers, if you use an outside person to do the research like us, just introduce us. Say, hey, you're a valued customer and we want to know more about you. And we've hired this guy. Do you mind talking to him? The ones that left or that do half and half, you can do that also. The ones who left, we go out and we do that research as someone from the industry without necessarily disclosing who our client is. Mm-hmm. And we do that research. And then you combine the three based on very correctly done interviews. Because if you're not careful, qualitative research mm-hmm. can completely send you in the wrong direction. You know, sometimes people lie. Sometimes they tell you what they think you want to know rather than what the truth is. So you gather that information. And almost every time we do it, just from that, the seeds that need to be planted are very clear. We get very, very clear. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. A steel drum industry. We worked with a company that the goal was eventually to sell the business. And we wanted to grow the business by a certain amount in a very short period of time. They were in the market. When I say steel drums, I mean those big 55-gallon jobs that hold chemicals and coatings, not mm-hmm. steel drums like you listen to in Jamaica when they play music. We talked to the manufacturer, we make it out of American steel. We can trace it back to the mill if there's a leak. We follow ANSI standards. We do drop testing in-house so that we can meet the transportation requirements. All of these things that we're so proud of. And all of them were, again, like at a poker game, table stakes, the very minimum. You can't be in the business if you don't do all those things that they're saying. We went to the market. We talked to the top 10 customers. We talked to the middle and we talked to people who said, we don't do business with them anymore. Mm-hmm. And what we discovered was none of the things they were proud of were the reason people did business with them. Number one, every single person we talked to, that company's biggest strength, they answer the phone. I don't get this crazy voicemail system. I can get to a person. I can ask a question. That was number one. Mm-hmm. Number two was, as a buyer, because of their flexible manufacturing, if I screw up or we have a change in production, no other drum manufacturer in the country can get me my order as quickly as they can. They can change their schedule and get it to me right away. And the third most important part of it was when they screw up, if we have a drum that leaks, if we have a shipment with a problem, they handle it. Other companies make us learn their internal process, bureaucracy. They make it very difficult for us to handle a problem that they caused. So when we change the messaging, stop talking about drop testing and standards and steel, and started talking about that personal touch customer service, save your business, never shut down because we care. They doubled the business in less than 2.5 years. And sold it for a premium well above what the expectation was on the sale of the business.
Sound advice and very interesting insights. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Des interviews, des chiffres, des faits, des études, pas de blabla. Ce sont les podcasts de Visionary Marketing, disponibles sur toutes les bonnes chaînes de balado-diffusion.
Surtout, n'oubliez pas de mettre une bonne note à ce podcast si vous l'avez apprécié.